give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Steve Kraft. I'm here on behalf of Talon J. Lee. I am appointed appellate counsel for Talon Lee. I've not been before this body in many, many, many years. But we all have one thing in common. None of us were there present during these proceedings. Appellate counsel, myself, and of course you. I'm going to give you a general argument, and then we'll get into more specifics. I'm going to try to focus on things pre-trial, things trial, and which is going to include jury instructions, and then post-trial sentencing. And as I said earlier, I haven't been here in a long time, so excuse me if I fumble around a little bit, because I'm not as...
Well, let me just jump you to a question right at the beginning here, though.
Okay, thank you.
What is your best argument that the testimony regarding the Iowa incident was not inextricably intertwined with the charges?
I'm sorry, say I...
What is your best argument that the Iowa offenses, I mean, Iowa incident was not inextricably intertwined, as the court found?
My best argument? Well, one is that it's after the fact. It's not prior bad acts, but it's other conduct, I suppose. I don't think it's, let me get to that portion of the...
Does that make a difference?
I get not under the current state of the law. But when I get to, let me find that section, please, sir. Oh, by the way, can I reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal?
You may.
Thank you. Sorry. I apologize. No way. Okay. That's why I'm having trouble finding it. I believe it has to do with the, I think the best argument is that combined with other arguments, it confuses the issue. And combined with the failure to give a limiting instruction, the failure to give an instruction as to the limited purpose of that evidence is probably the strongest argument, because then it's confusing, especially when you combine it with the other jury instructions. I guess it's fair to give the limiting instruction. To me, that's the strongest argument in that part of it.
But with regard to the limiting instruction, there was no objection to any instruction other than instruction number 5. So there was, at the time of the trial, no objection to that lack of a limiting instruction was entered, was there?
Well, I have two responses to that, Your Honor. And the first one is that would lend credence to ineffective assistance of counsel. The second part would be it's the court's province to instruct the jury properly under the law, not defense counsel or prosecutors. Granted, they have a right to present instructions and that sort of thing, but ultimately, isn't it, it's the court's province to instruct the jury properly. So if a failure to do it, seems to me, would be still objectionable if the court doesn't render a proper instruction, especially where evidence of this nature is coming in. And, you know, you have to remember the context of this case. I think particularly sexual assault cases are, well, let's just start out with the allegations, are particularly horrendous. So how the court guards the evidence that comes in or doesn't come in is particularly important, I think, in the sexual assault context, because there are assumptions that are made along the way that, well, if this person did this, they did that. And that's where I think it's especially important in this context.
Could the state have presented its,
I'm sorry, yeah.
Could the state have presented its evidence without making some kind of reference to the Iowa incident?
I think it was unnecessary. I mean, it was, when you think about what the evidence that was presented, without that, did they need it? Was it necessary? And also, I guess, finally, was it outweighed by its prejudicial effect? I mean, it really was. We have to remember in this context, the court had already allowed in evidence. They already allowed joinder of the two cases, and so there are multiple witnesses testifying to this sort of behavior. So, my argument to you is that wasn't not only was it not necessary, but it was obviously prejudicial.
In your argument, where do you think the trial court's instruction went wrong with respect to venue?
It's the classic, I think it went wrong with because of the counsel bluffs thing coming in, the counsel bluffs instruction becomes, I mean, the venue instruction could be misleading to a jury, especially without a limiting instruction. That's the heart of the thing to me. Because with that language that the argument was venue wasn't proven in that particular county, and I get it, Nebraska statute says you don't have to do that. But when you look at the statute itself, it talks about vessels, ships, canals, and those sort of things, and you combine letting in evidence of something that reportedly occurred across a state line, I think without the limiting instruction, that becomes very confusing, or a clarifying instruction of some sort. The jury could find that very confusing, and it's not clear. So you could base your conviction on that evidence.
Was there, if the Iowa evidence of the Iowa incident had been not admitted, if the evidence of the Iowa incident had not been admitted, would the case nevertheless warrant an instruction under 29-13-01-02 about events in cars?
I believe so.
So there, in your view, there is some proper evidence about events in cars.
I'm sorry, when you say limiting instruction, maybe I misunderstood your question.
Is there evidence of things happening in a car other than the Iowa incident?
Well, that's their thing. We don't, no venue of where the thing happened in the car. There's no evidence of that in the record as to where that happened.
Well,
and obviously
there
we're talking about,
isn't there evidence in the record that he took the child from Douglas County in the vehicle?
Yes.
Does that have some bearing on the necessity of that instruction?
I think it also, I understand the court's point, but I think it also, with the allowance of the Iowa evidence, it confuses the issue because it could be, we don't know. And also, the record doesn't show whether that was also in Iowa or where it was. And part of it is the proximity of Douglas County to Iowa. It's part of the problem. But that's where the thing becomes intertwined.
Well, was there, to follow up on Justice Funk's point, was there evidence that things happened in a car and that the car traversed some distances, quite apart from the Iowa incident?
Well, I don't know that we know where that traversing happened, and I think that's the problem.
That's not my question. My question was, is there some evidence that there was a car that moved from point A to point B regardless of how those are identified with particularity, but and things happened in a car that are included there, in the facts of the charge.
I agree, there is evidence of that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
The proposed instructions with the relevant language, instruction number 5 and instruction number 6, they are consistent with the statute, aren't they? Inconsistent in specifically in instruction number 5, the venue portion which to which you point out is consistent with 29.1301.01, is it not?
Yes.
And then instruction number 6 is consistent with 13.01.02, correct?
Correct. But that may not, under this context, may have not been a proper statement of law without a limiting instruction, would have been my argument to you.
What kind of limiting instruction are you saying should have been given?
I guess I'm referring to I think I mentioned it, as far as one that was mentioned by the court in a previous case. Sorry. I think basically the instruction has to do with focusing on these. You have to focus on the specific evidence and under each charge with each victim relative to the defendant, where there is evidence brought in that goes across individual lines, individual allegation lines.
So not as to any specific piece of evidence, as in, don't consider this. You were asking for a general limiting instruction of consider all the evidence.
Well, not unlike Knudsen, State versus Knudsen. In that case, they did find a difference, so they didn't need a limiting instruction because they found some charges not guilty, some charges guilty. I'm not mistaken.
Each charge has individualized elements in the instruction, correct?
Right.
So each one says what you have to find before you can find someone guilty or not guilty of each particular charge.
Agreed. But where you're allowing, I think it's further confused by the allowance of the for the other evidence is Iowa, the 412, no, 404 stuff.
So you're saying that it runs the risk of confusion to the jury?
I'm sorry?
Your argument is it runs the risk of confusion to the jury without that limiting instruction.
Right. Exactly. I think you've hit on what I consider to be the major issues that we're raising in this case. Ultimately, I guess I want to point out to the court that, when you look at what also happened here is the state defendant was not allowed to bring in its own evidence of other allegations of sexual assault by a brother, I believe, that was filed in juvenile court.
That would obviously that have to run past the rape shield law, 27.412.
I don't think.
What section to that rule do you believe that falls under?
I don't think the rape shield applies.
Then why not?
Because the particular it's not offered for the prohibited purposes. It's offered for the purpose that there may be other reasons why this child is aware of this sort of behavior at this age. And to me, that's distinguishable from trying to bring in evidence of prior sexual conduct for an improper purpose. it wasn't brought up to bring in prior sexual conduct of this individual in order to impeach or anything. It's brought up for the purpose of showing why this child may have knowledge about things that are a child at that age would not have knowledge of. And without it, and then there's no other explanation. And what's the harm of bringing it in? It's not brought in for an improper purpose. And when you combine allowing this, when you combine allowing in the state to bring in other evidence, all this other evidence that's not related to this specific case, or out-of-state evidence, and the defendant doesn't get to bring in evidence that might have some bearing on this issue, to me that's not a fair proceeding. And then when you don't instruct properly to erase the confusion, now we've got a further complication. Then finally, after all that, these sentences are, they're maximum and consecutive, and therefore I submit excessive.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis. Good morning to you.
Please call the state of the last Assistant Attorney General appearing on behalf of the Apple in the state of Nebraska. Lee raises numerous claims on appeal. I will focus on two, the admission of the Iowa sexual assault and the instructions on venue. As far as the admission of the Iowa sexual assault, we maintain it was properly admitted because it was intrinsically intertwined with the state's case and not subject to 404.
Mr. Liss, the blowers are making a little bit more noise than I usually hear. If you could speak up just a little, I would appreciate it.
Will do, and I'll back up. As far as the admission of the sexual assault in Iowa, we maintain it was intrinsically intertwined and not subject to Rule 404. I believe it was intrinsically intertwined.
Why is it not 404, and why is it inextricably intertwined?
I think there are three primary reasons here. I'll walk through each of them. Number one, set forth in our brief, it helped establish the timeline of the sexual assault. This was a subject of dispute at trial, the timeline was, and her testimony about the sexual assault in Iowa, along with her report at the ER on June 23rd, 2017, helped establish the timeline of sexual assaults in Nebraska, which were alleged to have occurred between January and March of 2017. So I think it was a pivotal piece of evidence in that regard. Number two, it provided clarity to RW's report at the ER and her report at Project Harmony. In both of those interviews, or both reports, she was asked what happened, and she explained that her dad, in one of the incidents, had put his private part in hers and in her behind. That, of course, referred to the Iowa incident because that was the only incident where that type of penetration had occurred. So I think the jury would have been confused to hear this type of penetration or this information in the medical reports and not hear any evidence to that effect. So we would submit it was relevant and intrinsically intertwined in that regard as well. And then third, it went toward the credibility of RW. Without the evidence about the Iowa incident, it would have appeared that more time elapsed than actually did before she reported the sexual abuse. This could have adversely impacted her credibility. So we would submit that it was relevant and intrinsically intertwined in that regard as well. For all three of these reasons, individually and collectively, we maintain the evidence was intrinsically intertwined and not subject to 404. Alternatively, as set forth in our brief, for the sake of argument, if it was not intrinsically intertwined, we would maintain that it would have still been admissible under Rule 414 anyway. Either way, we maintain the evidence was properly admitted and there is no merit to this claim.
Did the district court rely on 414?
It did two orders. In its initial order, it did. It went through and found that, as I read the order, this would be proper under 404. It would also come in because it's intrinsically intertwined, and it would also come in under 414. And then it later did a non-pro-tonk and amended that order and just went with the first two reasons, that it would come properly come in under 404, and it was intrinsically intertwined. It excised the 414 analysis. I'm not sure why. I don't think that matters, so it would be a question of law that you reviewed de novo. And when you look at that subsequent order anyway, I think, at least inherent in its findings, that this evidence would be proper under 404. I mean, it's necessarily then finding the evidence by clear and convincing evidence, which would really be the only requirement required for 414. So I don't think there's any obstacles there. I'm not sure why it did the subsequent order, but I don't think that poses a problem here to 414 or the 414 analysis, at least in our assessment. There are no further questions on that, I'll move on to the jury instructions regarding venue. The issue is whether the instructions with respect to venue were proper on counts 1 and 5, both of which pertain to the sexual assault in, of R.W. in the car. We maintain the jury was properly instructed on both counts. As set forth in our brief, the instructions that pertain to these two counts are instructions 5 and 6. Instruction 5 incorporates the venue section in 29-1301, which deals with an offense that is committed or may have been committed in multiple counties. And then instruction 6 incorporates the venue statute from 29-1301.02, which deals with an offense that occurs in a motor vehicle or some other movable vessel. The two instructions...
We don't know where that event occurred. Is that correct?
Correct.
Right. We know where it began, but we don't know where... And where it terminated, but we
right.
don't know where it occurred.
Right, which is, I think is why those instructions were appropriate. That's why they apply here. And I think the two instructions, when read together, and they need to be read together, they contain a correct statement of the law. They were warranted by the evidence, and they're consistent with other instructions that have been upheld in other similar circumstances, including this court's recent decision in State v. Mueller. So we would maintain that the jury was properly instructed.
How do you respond to the lack of the limiting instruction?
Twofold. Number one, it wasn't preserved. There was no objection to the court's instruction. There was no request for a limiting instruction. There was no limiting instruction tendered. There was simply nothing done in that regard. So I don't think the issue was properly preserved. But in any event, number two, I don't think it was warranted. I mean, limiting instructions in certain circumstances are necessary and advisable, say 404 evidence comes in. We need a limiting instruction to tell the jury what limited purpose that evidence can be considered. But with respect to charges, as you aptly pointed out in your questions, we routinely instruct the jury that these are the elements of the offense. I mean, here's the evidence as a whole, and here's the offense, here's the elements of it. Consider that with respect to the evidence and determine whether or not that offense was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm not aware of any authority that says we need to be telling them that, hey, we have several offenses here. Make sure you consider them separately and take the evidence separate. I mean, I think we can trust the jury to accomplish that, and that's why we instruct them as we do.
If the evidence with respect to incident in Iowa were excluded, would the venue instruction with respect to incidents in moving vehicles, the 29-1301.02, would that nevertheless have been warranted with respect to the remainder of the, I'll call it, proper evidence?
Yeah, I believe so. Because while we know that incident in the car started in Douglas County, we really don't know where they went after that. I mean, it's conceivable.
But the evidence isn't, this isn't a car, it was in a parking lot, did not move.
Once they got to wherever they went.
Wherever they
she
went.
She wasn't sure where they went.
Right.
They went to
okay.
a dark place with a lot of trees.
So the moving vehicle notion is supported by the facts.
Yes. Yes. As is the 1301.01 instruction of, you know, conceivably occurring in more than one county. I think the both instructions were warranted by the evidence. They were properly given, and certainly when read hand in hand, I think they were appropriate here. And I think on that point, when you read them hand in hand, it refutes the appellant's assertion that there was some risk here, that they would have taken this Iowa incident and perhaps concluded that this could have allowed them to conclude that, well, we're going to find him guilty based on what happened in Iowa. I mean, when you read those hand in hand, you can't get there. Instruction number 6 specifically says that it had to have occurred within this state. And that was a concern in Mueller. It was rectified here correctly. And when you read that language, there simply would have been no basis for the jury to say, well, we think maybe the Iowa incident is going to cover this car. I mean, you can't get there when it says it occurred in this state. Plus, we would submit that with respect to the offense in the car, there was absolutely no evidence that it occurred in Iowa. So we see no risk and no prejudice in that regard anyway. With respect to the remainder of the issues, I believe or hope I've thoroughly addressed those in brief. I'll submit those on brief to the court.
I have a question about the 27-412. Does evidence of a prior sexual assault fall within the terms of the rape shield law? And if so, which terms?
I think that would be excluded under that because, I mean, the only evidence you can bring in under that statute is going to be evidence of other evidence of semen or injury.
Well, the statute says that the following evidence is not admissible, and then it says evidence offered to prove that any victim engaged in other sexual behavior. Is someone who's assaulted, have they engaged in other sexual behavior, or does engaged imply some kind of consensual participation on their part?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know, and it could be fact-intensive, too, but there are plenty of instances where somebody is sexually assaulted and they're engaged in acts. I mean, they might be forced to do it. They might be manipulated. Any number of things happen in these types of situations.
But I think Justice Papik's question is ultimately going to a sexual assault is an assault, not a consensual sexual event by consenting persons and so forth.
Sure.
It's a type of assault, is it not?
It is. Okay. Yes. I was simply pointing out that within an assault, an individual can be engaging in particular behavior. And when you look at the overall purpose of that, though, it's to exclude information that might be, you know, harassing or insulting or suggest, you know, improper motives. And I guess a sexual assault wouldn't necessarily do that. But I mean, generally speaking, we keep all that evidence out for a reason. To answer your question, I think it would encompass an assault. I don't see why that would be admissible under that statute. I guess I'd have to think that through further, but my impression is that that would be excluded as well. Plus, and I mean, I guess with respect to this case and the evidence they sought to admit, that we have scant details about it anyway, but as I understand it, there was that allegation of the brother having done that, but it wasn't really fleshed out, and as I understand it, all of that was still pending, and we don't know that it necessarily was an assault. I mean, that seems to be the implication from the comments relayed by defense counsel, but I mean, perhaps there was something more to that, and that was part of the juvenile proceeding that was pending. We don't know anything about it.
Did the district court also exclude this evidence under 403?
Yeah, as I read its comments, it's got the oral comments as well as its order. The order seems to focus more on 412, but when I read its oral comments, I do think it was a 403 analysis, and it certainly pointed out we're not going to put her on trial with respect to this other incident. And to me, that's certainly a 403 type analysis.
So if we found it wasn't an abuse of discretion to keep it out under 403, we may not have to decide the scope of 412 as it relates to this evidence.
I think that would be fine, because I think it was absolutely properly excluded under 403. So, yeah, I think that would be an acceptable analysis. If there are no further questions, we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes.
4 minutes and 20 seconds, Mr. Kraft.
Again, thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. I guess in rebuttal, a couple of things I wanted to point out in reviewing the appellee's brief. Looking at the one of the arguments made was that the evidence was after the fact. How does an allegation after the fact set the timeline? Which is a claim that set the timeline. That's the reason why it was relevant. Where there's no statute of limitations applied because the victims are children. I mean, the statute of limitations would be many decades down the road, so I don't think that's a disingenuous argument.
Aren't child sexual assault offenses normally considered to have difficulty setting when they actually occurred because the children don't have the same concept of time?
But in this case, we're talking about 10 or 11-year-olds, so in the context of this trial, statute of limitations wasn't an issue. In other words, it won't expire while the trial's going on.
It won't affect the statute of limitations.
Right. That's only my point. So it's not particularly relevant for a reason to allow the evidence in so you can establish that. But more generally, I guess what I want to point out to the court, evidence is allowed in against him. Evidence he wants to bring in is not allowed in.
the evidence that's allowed him to bring against him, combined with the joinder of the offenses, and the lack of jury instructions makes, of the improper jury instructions I would submit to the court, which could confuse the jury and probably may have confused the jury. I can't say for sure. We don't know. We're on the jury. But I think I would submit to the court that under all those circumstances, Mr. Talon Lee, the appellant, did not get a fair trial. I would submit to court you need to send it back for a new trial. And the alternative, if you don't do that, the sentences in this case are of an extreme level. 112 years to life plus life on a young man. I say young man, he's not a boy, but he's not that old. And obviously it's clearly a life sentence with no prior record in, of this nature. And we have, we laid out for the court some cases that have been other sentencings within the jurisdiction that have had much less sentences for much more egregious and repetitive conduct. With that, I submit it to the court.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the last case of the day, which is Steuben Charitable Foundation versus Steuben. I am recused from this matter, and Justice Miller Lerman is recused from this matter. Justice Castle will preside over Steuben Charitable Foundation versus Steuben.
We'll wait momentarily to allow the judges to exit.